My name's Glenn Honberg. For the last 10 years, I've been leading the City Bible Forum, which is like a mission to the CBD with white-collar workers, people in suits, but making a change. Currently, I'm with my family. We're planting a church at Griffith University, so we're trying to reach out to the university community there and the students, so I'm kind of transitioning into that. I'm going to preach from Luke chapter 2. You want to have that open. Well, here I looked up online some of the best self-help books for women in 2018. I looked at the men's one, but the titles weren't as interesting. Here they go. Number three, I think, was Crazy Sexy Diet. Eat your veggies, ignite your spark, and live like you mean it. Or, by Ruby Warrington, Material Girl, Mystical World, The New Age Guide to a High Vibe Life. Black. Right. So I went to somewhere kind of a little more serious. It's the Business Insider magazine, and the writer there, her name's Shana, she said, at the end of 2016, I published a list of non-fiction self-help books that told me everything I needed to know about how to be happier, how to achieve my goals, how to become an expert at anything. And in 2017, I learned, surprise, I was wrong. The past year, I read another boatload of books on human behavior. You might call them self-help books, and gained brand new insights into the world of relationships, emotions, and money management. I'm going to talk a bit more about self-help books down the track, but I think one of the greatest insights of the self-help book and book industry is actually that we are desperate for wisdom. That to be human is to be desperate to know how to live well. That is fundamental to almost every human being out there. We are trying to work out, how do we do this life well? Walk into Dimmicks in the CBD, and down the up on the second floor, there's just a kind of half of the section on the wall is devoted to wisdom. People don't call it wisdom. They call it management books, self-help books, how to raise your children books, how to stop other people's children not hurting your children books. It's wisdom. We need wisdom. You've got a friend. They say something pretty rude and offensive, but they don't seem to realise that it's rude and offensive. And they said it to some people standing around, and you could see some of them were offended and some weren't. And do you say something? Do you say something then and there in front of everyone? Do you say something later? Will they understand? You need wisdom. You discover that your boss, and these are real life situations, that your boss has been treating other employees badly. You are getting the minimum wage, but they're from non-English speaking backgrounds. They don't really understand how the law works, and they're not getting the minimum wage. Do you say something? If you say something, well, you need this part-time job, you might well be the first person he asked to leave. You need wisdom. One of your kids is going off the rails, or perhaps one of your parents is going off the rails. We need wisdom. So much of life is a search for wisdom. What's the right thing to do? What's the best time to do it? What's interesting is, I think, kind of in summary, what we start to do is, though, focus on the externals of our life. What we eat. Pure organic food. What we wear. What we're seen to be doing. How is our career going? Are my children obedient? Will people still like me? Again and again, as we search for wisdom, what you see, the answers the world mostly offers, is eat your veggies and ignite your inner spark. It's actually kind of that external world, how you live it out. There's very little about heart transformation. And this is where discovering that Jesus is the wise guy really helps us. See, I don't mean he's the wise guy like as in the smart aleck, and I don't mean he's the wise guy like in the mafia. He's the wisest human being that ever lived, the true wise man. So we are often, if you're a Christian, you know that Jesus is the great prophet. He fulfills the great prophets. He's the great teacher. He's the great priest who stands between us and God. He's the great king. But the other category that Jesus fills is he's the great wise guy. He is the wisest man who ever lived. You might be thinking, well, good for him. Well, how does that help me? It's not Jesus who's working with unpaid workers, it's me. It's not Jesus standing in the middle of this conversation, it's me. It's not Jesus dealing with the angry neighbor. It's not Jesus. We're actually going to see how profoundly good it is that Jesus is the wise guy and how it's the greatest possible help. So let's get into it. Jesus is the wise guy. This is actually at the end of what's classically known as the infancy narratives. It's the last of Luke. Luke kind of introduces the kind of promises about Jesus and his fulfillment as an infant and child. It's Jesus as the wise guy. Look at verse 40. It says, and the child, that is Jesus, grew and became strong. He was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was on him. Just a beautiful introduction here. It's the end of the last bit where Jesus presented at the temple, or possibly the start of this next bit. But it's a beautiful mix. Jesus grows in strength and wisdom and grace. How often do you get that mix of strength and wisdom? We get a lot of strength. Think about every football player, the greatest. And then their stories turn up in the newspaper. There's not a lot of wisdom. Think of the powerful people in the media at the moment, Hollywood producers and leading actors who've got their power through their celebrity status, but not a lot of wisdom and no grace. But see, Jesus is growing. He won't stay a child, and the grace of God is on him. This is kind of saying again, Luke is saying to us again, that God is on the march. God is at work in the world. God's about to change things. The grace of God is at work in Jesus. So what happens? Well, it's a family ritual. Joseph and Mary are pictured here as faithful Israelites. Three times a year they were supposed to go up to Jerusalem, even if they lived a long, long way away. They go up, you can see there in verse 41, every year Jesus' parents went up to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. That's what the scriptures commanded. You can imagine Jerusalem would have been like a kind of Christmas and New Year's wrapped up together, so holiday mood, temple, special foods, regular people you saw, great auntie Esme, cousin Fred, and they all go up there together. Just like they've gone up every year. But this year is different. Everyone returns home, but Jesus stays in Jerusalem. Look at verse 43. After the festival was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but they were unaware of it. Thinking he was in their company, they traveled for a day. The passage makes this really clear. It's that Jesus, the boy, stays in Jerusalem. It's roughly a 3 or 4 day trip, scholars reckon, from Jerusalem to Nazareth or Nazareth to Jerusalem. It's a fair way. And they discover that Jesus isn't with them. I don't know what the conversation would have been at the local service station. What do you reckon it would have been like? I thought he was with you. Well, no, I thought he was with you. But no, wasn't he with his cousins? Wait, no, he's not with them. Why didn't you check? Why didn't you check? Well, where is he? They look amongst their traveling group, because they would have come up in big groups and down from the area. They can't find him. They go back to Jerusalem. It says that they looked for him for 3 days. Wait a second. Just think about this for just a moment. He is a 12-year-old boy missing for 3 days in Jerusalem, a city conquered by the Romans. Did the Roman soldiers take him? Have bandits or thieves hurt him? It takes them 3 days. Can you imagine the stress and anxiety? And here's the funny thing. I think it's so realistic. I think Luke is an eyewitness account. He's interviewed people, and I think it just comes out in this truth. Because where is the last place that you would look for a 12-year-old boy? Yeah, in a church. You've nailed it. He's going to be down at the Jewish arcade. He's going to be swimming at the pool of Siloam. He's going to be kind of out making trouble on the fringes of Jerusalem city. That's where they would have looked, I imagine. where all the Jewish candies are sold. So that seems like the last place they look is the temple. Verse 46, after 3 days they found him in the temple courts. But that's not all. Read on. Sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And then, verse 47, Jesus is the wise guy. Wait a second, he's only 12 years old. Verse 47, everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. Here he is in the temple with the leading Jewish thinkers. He's asking them questions, he's giving them answers, and people are stunned. And they should be. It would be like a 12-year-old boy going to Harvard University and talking to philosophy lecturers and them going, what? How did you think of that? No one's ever put those two things together before. What's going on here? See, what's the big point here? Well, actually, it's setting us up. Jesus is the wise, he's going to be the wise guy. If you think about this, he's only 12 years old and he's on par with the greatest spiritual leaders of the greatest spiritual nation the world has ever known. Let me make a few points coming out of this. See, Jesus is the wise guy. His knowledge and understanding at 12 is as good or even greater than the greatest spiritual leaders. But you notice what else? He's listening and he's learning. The Bible presents him as truly human, wanting to know God better, wanting to understand him. He's searching for wisdom to know God better. Second point here, Jesus is the wise guy because he actually knows God's will for him is more important than any other human will. It comes out all the way through Luke's gospel, but it's pictured even here. There's no sudden late discovery by Jesus that he's going to what his mission in life and what his plan is. Look at verse 48. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you. And Jesus' answer is like, why have you been searching for me? Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house? You see, what's going on here? Well, way back in 2 Samuel 7, in 2 Samuel, David said he was going to build a house for God. And from that point forward, the word house and temple kind of become synonymous in the Old Testament, but mainly for God's Messiah. So as you read through the Psalms written by David, the Messiah, again and again, the temple is called the house of God. And Jesus is saying, I'm the Messiah. See what he says? He doesn't say the house. Whose house does he say it is? My Father's house. It seems already Jesus knows he's fulfilling 2 Samuel 7 and all those promises in the Psalms about the Messiah dwelling with God. Where would God's chosen rather be? Well, of course he's going to be with God. In the meeting place between God and humanity, that's what the temple was. His answer to his parents is, don't you understand who I am? I'm God's true son. I'm the Messiah. See, and this makes Jesus the wisest man in the world because he knows God's will. He knows God's will for him and he knows God's will for the world. Who of you at the age of 12 knew God's will? It goes a step further. That's the second point on why Jesus is the wise guy. The third wise guy is that it's very subtle in Luke, but that Jesus is from God. Not in the language of my father, but actually later on when Jesus says that God is his father, well, let me read it out in John's gospel. This is John chapter 5. Jesus said to the Jews, my father, he healed someone, they got a bit cranky. My father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working. Verse 18 of John chapter 5. For this very reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own father, making himself equal with God. See, when Jesus is the wise guy because he has the perfect relationship with God and he's from God. He has the relationship that no other person has with God. He's from God and he is God. You can't get any wiser than that, can you? Who's going to know how best to live in this world? You'd think it'd be the Creator, right? The one who made it. That would make sense, wouldn't it? Jesus is the wise one. He comes to know God's word better, even as a child. He is the wise one. He's the great Messiah. He knows his place in the world and God's plan. He's the wise one. He is from God and he is God. He's the wise one. And he's wise in one more way. He's the wise guy because he lives the perfect human life. Look at verse 51. This is absolutely stunning. And 52. And then Jesus went down to Nazareth with them, Mary and Joseph, and was obedient to them. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. That actually is a surprise, don't you think? Wait a second, we've just learned that Jesus is the Messiah. We've just learned that he knows God's will. He's the great saving king, priest, prophet. We've just understood a glimpse that he is from God himself and he's God on earth. And he's got two fallible human parents who make mistakes, who lose their 12-year-old son. And what does he do? He submits to them. He is obedient to them. He is the wise man because he fulfills what it means to be truly human. God's order is that children might submit to their parents. And Jesus does it perfectly, even though he's God. Think about that. Mary and Joseph were just as weak and as fallible as we are, or as you are. No, and me too. You see me yesterday in the heat. Man, was I fallible. They needed a Savior just like us. And yet Jesus, being who he was, knew what was right and good and submitted to them. And he didn't just kind of live a holy life in the temple. That's where I think verse 52 comes in. It says, Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor, or grace again is the word there, with God and man. We kind of want to know what happened between Jesus and the age of 12 and the age of 30. Luke pretty much covers it in this verse, verse 52. It was common knowledge where Jesus lived of how amazing he was. It was common knowledge how amazing Jesus. See, some people are impressive in public, but in private they are rat dog stinkers. There's this massive gap between their public life and their private life. And only those closest to them, their wives, their husbands, their sons, their daughters, well, they know about it, but they keep it quiet because of shame. But with Jesus, there's no gap here between the public and private. Get this, he was a teenager growing up with perfect integrity. Think about that just for a moment. That's pretty stunning. I once was a teenager on a farm in the middle. Anyway, let's stop. His life was an open display of God's goodness, mercy, love, wisdom, and strength. Jesus is the wise guy because he lived the perfect human life that none of us can live. So what does this mean for us? Well, let me finish with why we need this wise guy, Jesus. One, his perfect obedience. See, he knew his Father's will and he kept it perfectly. He was the perfect son. Why does that matter? Well, if he was not, he could not have died for imperfect people and saved us. 1 Peter chapter 1 says this, "For you know that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down from your ancestors, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect." Jesus died in our place as the perfect sacrifice to redeem us, he says, to rescue us from an empty way of life. We're redeemed by Jesus' death. If you've trusted in Jesus' death, you've been rescued out of that emptiness. Christianity has at its heart that Jesus rescued us. The wise guy, Jesus, willingly used his wisdom to die for us are very unwise people. We need that wisdom, because if he wasn't perfectly obedient, he wouldn't be the perfect sacrifice. Second, we need the wise guy Jesus in another way. Why was he in the temple? Psalm 69 says this about the Messiah: "Zeal for your house consumes me. The insults of those who insult you fall on me." See, Jesus' death and his zeal for us were unique. We can't die for the sins of the world. But think about this for a moment. If Jesus is the wise guy, he thought it was wise that his zeal meant that he ought to die for God's cause. This has huge implications for us. As you get older, it's easy for your zeal to fade, isn't it? You become cynical, standoffish, self-protective, self-interested, only kind of half committing to other people, church programs, relationships at work. And why? Well, I think we've experienced a lot of failure. We've had a lot of things go wrong. We start to become self-protective. But Jesus' zeal and true wisdom took him to the cross. See, true wisdom is zeal for God. Let me say it again. True wisdom is zeal for God. In our world, it seems wrong to be zealous for religious things. It seems to be unwise. It seems to be dangerous. It seems to be damaging. Jesus didn't think so. He thought true wisdom was zeal for God, that he would leave his parents and go to the temple to learn and to think and to understand. That zeal for his father's house is what took him to the cross. True wisdom is zeal for God. But you might be thinking, well, I've been zealous and it doesn't work. I don't know about that. G.K. Chesterton, a Catholic writer, said this. He said, "The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried." I think that's right, isn't it? Yes, it's hard to live for God. But that doesn't mean it's not the wise life. And that doesn't mean it's not the good life. And that doesn't mean it's not having a profound impact. Jesus' profound wisdom meant he was profoundly full of zeal for God, and it led to his death. See, it's not a mistake when you live for God and things get harder. That's actually a natural relationship in God's order. But here's good news. Third point we get: we need this wise guy, Jesus, for the wisdom he brings us now. See, self-help books and wisdom books, they've got a lot of good things to say. I've used quite a few of them, especially in trying to work out how to run organizations and lead people better. But when you read them, they're mostly focused on the externals. Never mistake these external realities for spiritual transformation and spiritual wisdom. Let me read out to you Colossians chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. You could turn there if you wanted. Paul says this: "I want you to know how great a struggle I have for you," to the Colossian Christians, "and those at Laodicea, and all who have not seen me face to face, that their hearts might be encouraged, being knit together in love, to reach all the riches of full assurance and understanding and the knowledge of God's mystery, which is Christ. In Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge." Let me read that to you again. In Jesus, in Christ, are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. See, the great mystery of what is the universe about. Paul says in Colossians 1:27, "It is the hope of glory, God in Jesus in you." That's God's great plan. That's what the world's all about. That's the shape of existence. That's what life is about. That's what purpose is about. All treasures of wisdom and knowledge are found in Jesus. He's saying, if you want to understand wisdom, If you understand true knowledge, you cannot find it without reference to Jesus. Not true knowledge. He's saying Jesus is the wise guy. And if you want to know how to live well, you cannot look past him. And as you read on in the book of Colossians, don't worry, I'm not going to explain the whole thing, but actually in the book of Colossians, it reveals to us the problem. Paul again and again critiques that the Colossians attempted to live for the externals. How can they be God's people? Well, they eat the right kind of food, wear the right kind of clothes. It's what they're seen to be doing. It's how their career's going. It's making sure they keep up the external appearances. Again and again, the Colossians are falling for this idea that if they get the externals right, that they'll have the good life. And Paul says, no, it's spiritual transformation. Let me summarize his argument in Colossians with 3 points. He says, your hearts need to be zealous for Jesus. Colossians 3:1, since you've been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. He's saying, have Jesus as your absolute focus. Verse 5 in chapter 3, he says, be ruthless with sin. Kill sin. Verse 5, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. He's saying true wisdom, true zeal, true spirituality is not found in different food, different clothing, different diets, different house, different career, different relationships. It's found in a radical transformation of Christ in us from the inside out. And later on in chapter 3, he says, be changed to be like Jesus. He uses this beautiful image in chapter 3, verse 12. He says, clothe yourselves. Cover over yourself with compassion, grace, mercy, kindness. And he could go on, goodness, self-control, patience, gentleness. So as you read through the book of Proverbs, I'd say, summarizing the vast majority of the book of Proverbs is, how are you relating to people? What are your relationships like with people? Are you using them for money? Are you abusing them in your conversation? How are you treating people at work, at home, in your neighborhood, in your family? Earlier, I put forward 3 real situations. I'm actually not going to give answers to them. Because I think, see, that's the thing about wisdom. Its power is that it's needed for unique situations that you are going to be in. You're a unique person with gifts and skills that God's given and knowledge of Him. He wants you to bring that to bear this year. My answers for those situations are not the answers that you'll need for your situations. But there's this amazing promise of God that if we've trusted in Jesus, we have in us the spirit of the wise guy Jesus. He pours out his spirit on his people. Ask him, he will help you. Ask him to set your heart on fire for him this year. Ask him to help you be ruthless with sin and know how to live that out. Ask him to change you to be like Jesus. And what about if you're sitting here and you're not Christian? Well, I would say to you, look at the life of Jesus for yourself this year. He's the wisest man that ever lived. Why would you live without looking at him?